to define what I do and how I do it. I basically just do what I do and hope that this will be sufficient. So far I feel it has been so, but sometimes it is a little difficult for me to deal with definitions. Everybody has their different ways of explaining about themselves, about defining about themselves, about how they present things. But it's easier for me when I'm in a detached situation like this. I'm in somebody's flat. There's wires everywhere. It's a very complex technological setup. But when I'm in that temple in St. Petersburg, it is very, very clear to me. There's a huge difference between how I feel there and how, for example, I would feel if I am just speaking in a detached way. For example, my audience is not in front of me. The deities are back there, but it's a little different environment here. When I'm in front of the deities there in St. Petersburg, I feel very much according to the manner in which I really wish to present everything at its very base level of what I do is not something that easily can be defined. It's not something that very easily you can say it's 23 of this and 16 of that. It's something which is according to the way I feel. It's something which is according to the way I am experiencing the connection with, for example, Radha and Krishna or Lord Chaitanya or whatever deity I'm connecting to at a particular moment. If you ask me to detail that connection, how exactly is that connection there? Well, I would have a very hard time. I would not be able to say it's this step, that step, this step. I would say that it's a feeling. It's how I feel. It's my personal connection. It's my personal feeling of love that allows me to connect to the deity or to the divinity. And it's not like a step-by-step process or something that I could break down into a first you do this and a then you do that. Now, I know that's not very satisfying when somebody wants to reproduce something that somebody else is doing. And I do understand and respect very much when people do that. When people are able to reproduce what they do for the sake of others so that others can do exactly what they do. You see this amongst mathematicians. You see this amongst physicists. You see this amongst computer programmers. Anybody who does something technical. You see this amongst physicians or anybody who deals with a particular science where there is a system of vocabulary, where there is a system of definition which very clearly states the elements within the process, which very clearly states the words which are used, the technical terminology, to specifically describe every element within a medical or technological or scientific field. When you talk about spirituality, I have seen that often the spiritual practice breaks down at the point of definition. In other words, when we start to define terms, we lose contact with what it is that we are attempting to define. For example, if you wanted to start to define love as a phenomena. Now, you can define weather as a phenomena. You can say there's a dark blue cloud, it will create rain. There is a there is rain. It is wet. It has a certain volume. It fills a glass so much. The sun has a certain intensity. So weather, you can define easily. And anybody can look it up on the internet and understand it. But how I feel in the weather is very hard to define. For example, when it was today or yesterday, kind of, for me, cold. The people I was walking with said, oh, it's quite warm today. It's very nice. So this is subjective. We have our kind of absolute ways of defining. We can measure it. It's quantifiable. So much rain, so many degrees, and so on. But when we try to understand how I feel about it, that is subjective. You can't quantify it. You can say, I feel good, or I don't feel good. Well, how much good do you feel? A pound of it? A kilo of it? It's not possible to define, I feel specifically that good. Love is one of those qualities where you can talk about it. You can say, you can talk about what you think love would do. You might say, for example, love is kind. Then at the same time, you might say, well, sometimes it might not seem kind to the person who's receiving it. There's a term in America called tough love, where you have a child who is not acting properly, who is making what seems to be quite serious mistakes in his or her life. So a child may be doing something which is not very beneficial for them. They may be, for example, careless about money. They may be careless about what they are eating or drinking or whatever. So a parent may find that after quite some time of trying to very peacefully and carefully transform that child, the parent may suddenly decide that the best thing to do is to tell the child to leave the house, or to tell the child they can't go out anymore, or to tell the child that they have to do this and that's all there is to it. Now, if we were to define love as a kind thing, the child would say, this is not at all kind, this is cruel and harsh. But the parent would say, well, this is my kindness to you, because I'm forcing you to do what's right. And when you do what's right, it will be beneficial for you in the long run, and you will make great benefit in your life. And that's my love. From the child's point of view, the child will say, I don't see that as love at all. You are repressing me. You are forcing me. And in fact, even that may change the way the child sees the parent. The child may even be damaged because of that in some way. So, if you were to use words like, well, love is kind, or love is warm, or love is sweet, or love is, you might find that under specific circumstances, these definitions do not equally apply to all persons, or all places, or all circumstances. In other words, when you start to define love in subjective terms, there are always situations which could be quite different. Now that is a big problem. That's why when people speak in terms of spiritual love, there are many directions to approach spiritual love. Some people see spiritual love in terms of just loving yourself, loving others, demonstrating that by the way you act towards them. Some people see it in terms of showing love to all living beings, as in animals or in plants. Some people see it in terms of protection of others, giving them security, or facilitating them in some way so that they may be assisted to do something which is valuable to them or which they want to do. Some people say spiritual love is only when you accept, for example, Jesus Christ as your Savior. That's the only spiritual love there is. There is nothing more than that. Anything, some Islamic people say, if you do not accept Allah, you have no connection. Other people may say it in terms of Vishnu or Krishna, or depending on their religious inclination, they might demand a certain kind of action or a certain kind of activity or a certain kind of external presentation of their love before it would be accepted as actually spiritual. Now, I would like to suggest that a very good definition of love would not include any of these elements, these external elements. It would not include elements which would have conditions to them that love manifests like this. If you can do like this, you have love. Or that if you act like this, there is love. Love can also be quite something which doesn't involve much action. How many times have you loved somebody who you had no chance to reciprocate with? What if you love somebody who's no longer living? Let's say they're a departed soul, somebody you love very much who is no longer in this world. How do you display that love with some kind of action? That love is there in your heart, and you express it, and you feel connection, but you can't really do anything. Of course, somebody can say, and I know this is said a lot, that you can act according to their desires when they were alive, fulfill their desires when they were alive. But often, when these personalities are no longer with us, their desires of what they want, for example, us to do, change. Their opinion about things transforms, because naturally when they are off of this earthly platform and they see with a different perspective, how they view things and how they want things to be can transform radically. And there are many examples of this that are documented in esoteria. So, of course, this is not scientific. But I have experience of people who were a certain way during life who, when they have an opportunity to express themselves after this life is over, in my perception, which is very subjective, they express themselves quite differently from another point of view, with another kind of a wisdom which says that actually it's okay the way you're doing it, or don't change, or actually you need to know this thing which you didn't know before, or whatever. In any case, I gave this example to show that you can have a loving relationship with somebody who is far away, even not living anymore in this world. And that love can be something which is just the product of the heart. It doesn't require any particular kind of action. And still, it is every bit as real love, it is every bit as powerful love as any love you can manifest or anyone can manifest in this world, face to face with others. Now, for example, let's say you're a regular person, even a regular devotee kind of person or whatever. Let's say you have some love for the deities here. Now, let's say you come not only here, but in St. Petersburg to the temple or any temple anywhere. And you come before the deities, and the deities are very nicely taken care of. And you just feel such love for them. Is that less than the love, for instance, somebody who's a pujari might manifest? Pujari, somebody directly connected with the deities. Sometimes those who are directly connected with the deities or with some great personality. See them in terms of daily, day-to-day activities. Doing some washing of their plates or washing of their paraphernalia. Or it's something which is related to their eating or whatever it is that they may be doing. Their festivals and so on. Now, that's an example of how a person can just be passively offering love to the deities and actually feeling it more than a person who's directly connected with the deities, whose mind may be absorbed in practical day-to-day affairs. Now, I would never even think of trying to make a qualitative difference between their love. I'm not trying to say that a person who worships the deities like that has less love than a person who comes and offers their love to the deities. That's, of course, would be foolish to say. And it's also not what I think. What I meant by this example was that it's very hard to understand. It's actually very hard to understand what is love by dealing with it in terms of situations or placing love within even beneficial situations, as in a deity room in the temple. Because maybe a person has chosen to display their love by taking care of the deity. And another person has chosen to display their love by doing some work somewhere else and coming before the deity. Now, what is the most important point is how do you define that love? Whenever we define love, we usually do it in terms of statements such as we do this, we do that, we involve ourselves in activities. And when we do these different kinds of activities, this is love. For example, I'll give you an example. It's a funny example and very relevant here. And I hope nobody gets insulted. I'm very picky about what I eat. And I like to have a lot of control over it. But when I come to Russia, it's practically as if I come under the control of others. And they are determining what I want to eat. And so it's out of love. I see it. I see this love. It's like, eat this. I made it for you. And that's love, of course. But I'm saying, like, but I don't want to eat that. So from my point of view, love is, you ask me, what do I want? I say, I want like this. And you say, okay, I'll get that for you. Somebody else may say, this is especially true like in Bengal. In Bengal, you cannot say, I don't want to eat that. It doesn't work. I remember Bengali devotees, I would try to eat sometimes and they'd be feeding you and feeding you and feeding you. And then even you put your hands like this over the plate, they put it on top of your hands. That's not very cultured. And it's also sometimes funny, but it's an expression of the fact that somebody feels that I wish you to take this from me because this is the expression of my love and you have to accept it. Now, if you were to ask me what I think of that, I would say, I think that's false because it's not that I have to accept your expression before the fact I recognize the fact that there is love there. I have to love myself enough to say, your love cannot ruin me. And that actually, if I was to define how love should be, I would say, you should act towards me in a way which is compatible with me, not in a way which is compatible with you. Now, when we are before the deities, when you are in relationship of love with the Supreme, with the Divine, you will find that there all these factors arise, all these factors come up, and that defining love becomes very complex. In other words, you may do something which you think is love, but because you may not have a direct feedback with the deity may not tell you, actually, that's not very well cooked. And it didn't come with enough love to make it palatable. The deity might not say that to you, but it might be true. Now, of course, one may think that's not possible, but it might be possible. So in that case, your expression of love would be clumsy, would be awkward. Now, I feel personally, and this is very relevant to the way I am, and very relevant to the way I express these discussions we have, the way I express this, is that love is. It's a state of being. It is not connected with doing. It may give rise to doing. You may act out of love. You may act with love. But love is simply what it is. It is a state of being. It is that feeling. It is the core energy of every being. It is the core substance of spiritual life. That connection between yourself and someone else you love is at its essence, simply that feeling of love, that beingness. And when there's actually a connection between two beings, and there's a reason we use the word beings, when there's a connection, a real connection, between two beings, the real connection simply is. It is, again, a state of being. I have my state of being. You have your state of being. When we connect in love, that is again a state of being. Now it's a different state than my state alone and your state alone. When we combine in love, that state of being that is developed is a very unique state of being. It is a new mixture of beingness. The same principle is active, whether this is going on between two people, or a person and an animal, or a person and a plant, or a person and the deity. It does not matter who these two beings are. The principle, the point of it, is that their love connects. This is a state of being. This is something which is so essential to love. Now, one might speak of love as a detached kind of thing. There is no particular attachment of love between any individual. You just feel love for all beings. You are emanating love in all ways. That's all right. I mean, you can feel like that. But that would be tested, in a sense, when your love faces a situation where love would act. Now, if you remember, in the beginning, we said that love is a state of being. Love is not a state of doing. That state of being that is love gives rise to action. It empowers action. It directs action. It is something which is born. Action is something which is born of that love. Now, let's say you love all living beings, but a living being comes to you and needs your help, needs your assistance. Or a living being has a very specific difficulty. Love tries to be of service, tries to be of assistance. That's how love is. Love wishes to be of service because the service is required. I have seen amongst many spiritualists, and we've talked about this before, that in their system of definition, we only have that love connection to God and we render service to God and we don't get involved in mundane, quote unquote, activities for others. Now that's okay, I suppose, if you're in a particular tradition and you want to see things like that. But I would say that if you really love the Supreme, then naturally you would love the energy of the Supreme. You would see Krishna's energy is everywhere. I think he even said in the Bhagavad Gita that when you have come to finally understand the truth, you will know that all living beings are in me and they are mine. So you would have a very hard time to start making distinctions between one living entity and another. You certainly wouldn't want to start talking in terms of friend and enemy, or higher and lower, or better and worse. You would see out of love all living beings and wish to be of service as you can. Now, I know that some people act in ways which are not very nice. They hurt others. You may even find a person may murder others. Now, I've talked a lot about this, not in these lectures, but in other places, about criminals, about people who do things which are really nasty, as far as a spiritualist definition of the term. And I've tried to give a point of view which has been expressed in the past. I do not claim it to be original. But from a spiritual point of view, how one would see a criminal, how one would see somebody who's acting improperly. I would like to say, for example, let's say we would have to examine the childhood of that person. We would have to examine the situation they had between themselves and their parents, or themselves and maybe they didn't even have parents they knew. Maybe they lost their parents when they were young. Maybe they had to be brought up in an orphanage. Even worse, maybe they had nowhere to live. Russia, where I am now in Moscow, there are more homeless children in Russia than anywhere in the world. It's one of the most horrible things I can think of. It really makes me sad. I've always wanted to make some kind of like foundation here to help homeless children. Because these kids, they have nothing. No parents, no place to live. So imagine, somebody grows up like that. And imagine even worse. I mean, please let's hope this never occurs again, but it will. But anyway, that child is abused. Sexually harmed. So that person is, from the very beginning of their lives, traumatized in such a way we cannot imagine. We who live in this very wonderful modern society with all of these internet connections and all of these gadgets and our widescreen TVs and so on, we cannot imagine the situation of these children. We cannot imagine the situation of people in other places where even eating is an enormous difficulty. And so therefore some start to steal to take care of their families. I'm not talking now because it's much more difficult to talk about, like for example, the executives of Enron who stole millions and billions. They didn't need to eat. I'm not talking about that. But still, what I'm saying would apply to them, but it would be much more difficult to do it in public like this. I'm speaking about really traumatized kids who grow up to be very disturbed individuals. These very disturbed individuals can do horrible things. Why? Well, society doesn't really care why. Society says there's a law, and you follow it. And if you don't follow it, we lock you up. And so the prison is filled with very disturbed people who, as soon as they finish their sentence, go out of the prison in the exact same disturbed state. Well, what's amazing is there are millions of people who are disturbed in various ways. Take these people who steal from all the shareholders. These are disturbed individuals. These are people who think they need to define themselves by enormous wealth. These are people who think the world owes them enormous wealth. These are people who think that there's something wrong in their lives unless they get it from you. And it doesn't matter if you suffer for it, as long as they can get. You can look back in their lives. You can see parents who didn't care about them, didn't acknowledge them, didn't even love them. Or also, again, you can see so many problems with people who are abused as children in one way or another, or beaten in one way or whatever. You can find the seeds of this, what we call bad, always in the past of the person. I'm not saying that justifies it. I'm not saying that rationalizes murder, horror of any kind, not at all. But what I am saying is that often these people who we might just throw totally as sinners, as evil, we may even use the definition of demon, are people who are traumatized, people who need help more than they need condemnation. I don't think anybody needs condemnation. Everybody needs some kind of help. And one who has that vision of love sees the evil, so-called, thing and sees this very disturbed person and tries to figure out some way to do something about it. Maybe they can do something directly. Maybe they become a therapist. Maybe they become a social worker. Maybe they create a charity. Maybe they do whatever they do. Or maybe they don't have facility to do that. Maybe they just sit somewhere in a kind of peaceful place and they're just sending love throughout the world to heal the world. I would put myself maybe in the latter category because I don't really have all that much facility right now. I'm working on it, to do much for others. I can try to speak about these things. I can sit and send love as best I can. I can bring others together to send love to try to correct situations. But the world is big. The problems are vast. But if you were to ask me to start delineating good and bad, evil and good, even demons and devotees, I would have a very hard time because I'd like to see things in terms of how I can be of service. I don't like to make categories and start putting everybody in a category because the categories can bewilder you. You will find in every religious tradition, every religious institution, people who fit within the categories I just described before as evil or bad, criminals. You will find in every religious hierarchy, every institution, child abusers, people who steal money, people who steal things from others, people who exploit others, even demanding them do things which may have no connection to their spiritual advancement. So, I would not want to start getting into these kinds of delineations because I think they don't divide what is spiritual and what is material. Of course, I have great experience of all kinds of spiritualists who argue with me about this point, especially those who are within traditional religions. They say you must have good qualities. You divide this by good qualities, and you must follow, and you must do these disciplines, and then you will not have these problems. Now, okay, whatever. You may think like that. But I would question this because we're dealing with constantly changing situations. We've even seen, even you look in, let's say, in the Bhagavatam, or something that's always annoyed me very much. You have a person who's a brahmana, very intelligent, very learned, very spiritual. But as soon as somebody does something wrong they don't like, they curse them. And then that person has to go through all kinds of trouble for thousands of years just to overcome the curse. I mean, sorry. If you did that nowadays, somebody would shoot you in the head. And you would deserve it. This idea to curse others, it's just too weird. And then the other idea. You do something very good for somebody, they bless you. That's very kind of business-like. You satisfied me, you give me something I like, whatever it may be, I bless you. If you were to ask me how I see it, I see that everybody deserves our blessings. Each and every one of us. Each and every one of us deserve to have the blessings of each and every one of us. Because when we stop making distinctions on who deserves, who doesn't deserve, who should have love, who should not have that love, we start getting into trouble. And even when we pick, they should have our love. But one day they may change in some way. And then you will say, they should not have our love. This is all based on external things. If you see love as this beingness, you don't make so many distinctions between who deserves it, who doesn't deserve it. You didn't see Lord Chaitanya do like that. That person deserves love, that person doesn't deserve love. There are people over there who never deserve love. You never hear this in Lord Chaitanya's life. You never hear this constant division philosophically between all of these points by dividing this group and that group. You do not hear this constant division between people. You feel in Lord Chaitanya's life this connection. The whole theme of Lord Chaitanya is connection. This beingness that he is connected with any other being. And that relationship is not defined. It doesn't have to be defined in terms of so many of this quality, so many of that quality. And you don't find Lord Chaitanya saying, this person is worthy, that person is not. Because everywhere, everybody became overwhelmed with Lord Chaitanya's love when he just simply embraced everybody and it spread all over. Now, I will go back to what I said at the very beginning. I respect very much when people define, delineate in very specific terms, quantitatively and qualitatively, exactly what they see is going on in their particular system and discipline. But I don't think these things apply when you deal, for example, with Lord Chaitanya. I know they don't apply to me as a person. Not that I'm making any comparison between me and Lord Chaitanya, it just happened to be in the same paragraph. And I think many are like this too. For some people, very specific delineation between this point, this point, this point, in terms of numbers, in terms of quantities, in terms of groups, that's a good thing. And those people should not be discouraged from doing that. I mean, I would never do it. But I don't live like that. I don't act like that. And I don't present like that. Because I can only present what I am. If people ask what I do, I say, well, I don't really do much, but what I present is 100% from my experience. In other words, what I'm saying is my experience. It's what I feel. It's what I know to be true. And therefore, I certify it as something that I know to be true. I cannot certify it that you know it to be true. I cannot even certify it that this is the best thing for you to do. I cannot certify in terms of this is a process. It has a name. It has steps. I can't say that. I have no name for this. It's just me talking. If I were to try to put it in comparison to something else, I would say, well, it's not like that, and it's not like that. You know, it's a very important methodology when you're trying to define things to be able to say what it is not and what it's not like, because it narrows the possibility of what it could be. Even more importantly, if I compare something to something else, I make a contrast. For example, if some spiritualist would want to say that the most important aspect in spirituality is the difference between yourself and the Supreme, then I would have an opportunity to express how I feel by making a contrast to that point. By saying, well, I don't see it like that. I see the most important thing is making the similarity between yourself and the Supreme. In other words, it's an opportunity to discuss and describe what you do by seeing it in terms of some other way of seeing things. And I think that's very healthy. You probably never heard of this guy, but there's a professor in America, his name's Garuda, Graham Schweig. He wrote many nice books, like, for example, the books about Rasa dance. He's come out with a fabulous, absolutely fabulous translation of the Bhagavad Gita in English. When you read Bhagavad Gita translated this way, you go, aha, 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 aha. But I haven't had a lot of discussions with him because he's a busy guy. But those discussions I've had have been very valuable to me because I've been able to define myself in terms of this very erudite Vaishnav scholar, this very intelligent, very learned person. I'm able to define myself in relative terms to this person and to challenge his usage of words, to challenge the terminology he uses and the definitions he gives to those terminologies. And I think that's fabulous. It clarifies for everybody, especially when he is saying, yes, that's a better way to see it because it brings out this point, which is what I believe. And I would say, yes, that's very good because this brings out what I believe and I see. That my experience brings me to this understanding. And it's really it's a marvelous experience. And there's no judgment in it. Oh, what you have said is not according to that book. It's not like that. In his mind, he's not the rare personality. It just happened to come in my mind, this example. But we are searching for truth. We are seekers of the truth. We are not seekers to memorize. We are not seekers to just believe something we read. We are seekers of the truth. We want to know whatever that truth is. We don't mind whatever it is. It does not have to be anything. You see, if you wish to go into some kind of let's say, description of what is the truth. And in your mind, it has to be a certain way. It, for example, it has to be the way that person described it. or it has to be the way that book described it. Otherwise, it cannot be truth. That format is not a format of seeking the truth. That is a format of simply accepting what you are told. Now, that is okay for people who need to do that. Some people just need to accept something like that. And they need to be told it's like this, like this, like this, like this, and like this. And they just put away their minds and just accept. I know we used to joke in Germany how the only way you could actually ever join the Hare Krishna temple is if you were a failed suicide attempt. And you would come and you would just accept because it would be a great relief for you from the pain of your life. But contrarily, a seeker of the truth is somebody who doesn't mind accepting some idea, doesn't even mind embracing that idea, if it is what they taste as truth. If the truth is vibrating within it. Now, what is truth? That's another impossible topic. I know if Kamala Mulla was here, he's busy, has to take care. There's a seminar going on. He would be the first one to start discussing truth because for him this is a very important thing, as it is for us who are seekers of the truth. Obviously, if you're a seeker of the truth, what is truth is incredibly important. It's the essence. Now, how do you define truth? I'm not even going to touch that subject. That's a whole nother lecture. What is truth? But, as far as I'm concerned, when I'm seeking it, I know when I find it. Now, I know that's a kind of a backwards way of defining it. But when I find it, I know it's true. Because it resonates with me as a person. It harmonizes with me as a person. It resonates in such a way that it just leads me on in my evolution. These truths that I seek are those truths which are of my essence, which are related to my essence in my connection with the deities, which are that which brings my love to this focused capacity to be of service. My truth might not be found in a book. I like the truth of Bhagavad Gita when Krishna says, "You'll see all living beings are in me and they are mine." Because it enables me to see people differently. Not because I read it, but because I feel it. I feel it when I look at other living beings. They may not look at me nicely. They may not like me at all. They may be nonsense. They may be criminals and so on. But when I look at them, I see how Krishna's words are of course true because I feel that everywhere. I feel their energy. It's what I do. They're all part. They're emanating that energy. They are of that grasped oneness that is Krishna's energy. These little individuated beings walking here and there. Just because one is more aware than the other doesn't make them any less beautiful as what they are. But that beauty is often covered. And that sometimes I might feel sad about it. And sometimes, when and if there's an opportunity to do something, I will do something. That doesn't mean I have to start, quote unquote, that horrible word that freaks us all out, preaching. It is not that preaching has to take place to help them. I may help them simply to come over, for example, an addiction. Or a trauma, or a pain in their life, which has been blocking their movement, the flow of their energy. Sometimes people can't relate to spiritual life because their whole life force is stuck on a trauma they had. Sometimes people aren't able to develop their spirituality because they're addicted to something which is blocking their evolution. So, sometimes I just want to help them move that one step. If it doesn't manifest for 6 lifetimes, I don't care. I'm not fruitive in that sense. I'm not trying to glorify myself. That's not the point. I mean to say, I don't do it because I need to see right now some result. I'm patient. It can take time. I don't care. But I would be very upset if that which I did had no result. That would mean I'm not connected to these people. And that would mean my love is not very strong because I'm not able to connect. I'm not able to have our love connect on the platform of love, which everybody has. I mean, of course, some people are so covered. I'm being idealistic in this discussion, so you're going to have to forgive that. I feel very idealistic today. I've had one of those days. So, that love, specifically that I'm talking about, is that love that just reaches out because it's just the nature of love to do so. It's very hard for love to just stay closed up. You know, if you would imagine it in a box, you would just have a little box and you would put love in it. Love is not something that feels happy in a box. Love is something that feels happy when it's flowing, because it's an energy. The quality of all energy is its flow. So love has to flow, and love does not like to be boxed up. Love wants to flow. Love, and how would love flow? It's not like love flows into a cup. It's not that kind of flow. Love flows in the channel ways of love. Well, what are those channel ways? Think about it for a second. What are those channel ways? Now, let's talk about this cup. I can actually love this cup because it's so big. I think it's a really cool cup. It's huge if you see it. It's like one of the biggest cups I've ever seen in my life. And I can think it's really great. But I would have a very hard time loving this cup. I mean, loving it. Like, you know, I would love my wife, for instance. Love the cup. That one I wouldn't be able to do it. Now, maybe some of you out there can love the cup. You're more advanced than me. You have this capacity. I'm not saying it's not possible. I'm just saying I cannot love a cup. Not in the same way. That makes me think the channel ways of love are between others who are also capable of love. Love finds itself in others. That energy that flows from me will find that love in another person. That is why these deities here are different than any other statue. Because when my love flows to them, their love flows to me in response. That makes it different than any other statue. You can go in the Louvre or wherever it is to Venus de Milo. Beautiful statue. So you offer your love. You won't get a reciprocation. The proof of the deity is the reciprocation of love. You can talk all you want, philosophy, blah, blah. But any person, doesn't matter who they are, they could know nothing about philosophy. And we see this all the time in St. Petersburg. You connect them in love with the deity, they believe because they feel it. They know they're alive. Sometimes I tell them they're more alive than we are, but they're alive. They know it. People, everybody knows it. They feel it. That, you didn't have to convince them. You didn't have to tell them there's a 20 million philosophical shastra references that explain that deity is God. You don't need it. And they don't even care if the deity is God or not. They just say, whoa, that's beautiful. I love that. That makes me love. I want to share that love. And that's what I've been talking about. Love finds love. You can find that with the deity, even if you know nothing. You find that with people. And when you feel that love, it heals. It heals yourself. It heals others. Being that loving person heals others. And that spreading that love is a big healing. But if you, let's say you're a person who has a some kind of like you're going to speak to others. Now, you don't really have that connection of love with them. You're speaking because you think what you say is going to help them a lot. And in that speaking, you'll be telling them, what you're doing is not good. You should do what I'm saying. That's much better. Why? Because of this and this and this. Now, even though that's kind of like considered a good thing, the other person may not feel it that way. The other person may feel put off because it's making a distinction between you and them. And worse, you know more than they know. Therefore, you are better than they are. Whenever you have a higher and lower, love becomes very difficult. Very difficult. In fact, it's destroyed. I know more than you. I'm better than you. Love cannot flow. Words, maybe. Conflict, absolutely. But love doesn't flow. To love and express that love, you have to embrace. That's why some people never connect to the deities, devotee people, whereas a normal person has no problem. Because that devotee person may be often very convinced that there is a better and a worse. And amongst me and the deity's better, I'm worse. I'm bad, actually. I'm very low because I'm fallen. But the deity's great. So therefore, the love is not flowing. Now, of course, somebody may say, that's their problem. But reality, when you really want to make that love flow, you can't stand there and say things like, you're better, I'm worse. You understand what I'm saying if you've ever had this experience. You just have to open yourself totally and have enough faith that God is not going to judge you and God does not care what situation you're in. You just stand before God and say, here I am, please accept me. I love you. And just express that love. And just feel that love from the Supreme. There's no need to start standing in front of God and define yourself. I am fallen. I am lowly. That's redundant. If God is God, God knew what you were before you even came to the temple. God doesn't need you to waste time. I'm this, I'm this, I'm this, I'm this. Shut up already. Just feel. Often we talk about bhakti. And bhakti is very interesting in terms of its true meaning, not in terms of the meaning of its definition. Bhakti means love. Period. That love between the living entity and the Supreme. Now, the reason we start talking about bhakti in various ways is because we use the term bhakti to put it as a title above what someone might do in that tradition. So they practice bhakti. They are bhaktas. This is important to speak with a jnani, a sankhya, a yogi, whatever. Or even somebody who's doing another kind of tradition, whatever. Because you have a very easy way to define what you are and speak with somebody else about it. But ultimately, that which makes you what you are is that you at least try to have love and connection with the Supreme. And then, although this is not necessarily part of the essence of bhakti, it is tacked on as important what you do about it. So you do this and you do that, and that's considered devotion. All these things that one does. Now, again, Let's go back to the very basis of love, because the definition will become clearer. Love is a state of being. It is. And love gives rise to various kinds of actions. So when you love, you act in certain ways. From that point of view, devotional service makes sense. What you do for the deities is an act of love. If you chant or pray, it's an act of love. If you are meditating and making connection, it's an act of love. If you are cooking for others, these are acts of love. Even if you do something in a mission or whatever, I don't want to go through the whole thing, these are acts of love. The act itself is not necessarily bhakti. It's the love that is the bhakti. Example, I take care of the deities, I wash their plates. But I don't feel love when I'm doing it, I just do it because it's a job. There are plenty of people in India who worship the deities as a job. That's not bhakti. Therefore, to help people understand how to better approach the deity in love, Krishna speaks about karma yoga. Working. Doing something. For example, I'm washing the deity's plate. It's for the sake of the deities. I get some help. But all of this is only to bring you somewhere. And where is the where you got to get? That when you do something, you do it with love. That loving connection is there between you and the Supreme. Now, that is the bhakti. That every scholar who ever studied the tradition of bhakti would agree, but there's so much talk around bhakti that it gets confused, the essence. The essence is not brought up as the essence. So, I say, I don't need to define myself in terms of others, so I put away the bhakti, put away all these things, and I say, there's only love. Okay, if somebody were to ask me about myself and my definition of how I would speak about what I do, because again, everything started out because I found it interesting having to come into the situation where I have to understand what to do. You know, not what to do. The situation of what it is I do, if I was to explain it to someone else. I would say, again, that I try to facilitate people's connection, that their love shall arise within themselves, and they shall connect to the Supreme, and as they connect to the Supreme, that expression of love will manifest. Because once you are connected, everything just works out automatically. You are inspired what to do. You are inspired how to act. You are inspired to work for the benefit of others. And you feel very closely resonating with the desires of Radha and Krishna or Lord Chaitanya. So what more does one need than to connect with one's own essence, one's love, and connect with the Supreme? Because once one does that, everything else happens automatically. That's what I do. I mean, I know it's only a little paragraph. I know you can't write a book about it. It's not like you can define it this way, that way. You can't make 16 of those and 3 of these and 45 of those and 86 modes.